this week of Moral Victories, episode number 8. We are rushing through. Doug and I have Yankee tickets. Maybe they're going to be out of the playoffs by the time this airs. Doug is up at Yankee Stadium, and I am on my way now. But first, we're here in the building to give you episode number 8. Matt Fortuna of The Athletic joins me to talk a little bit of college football. And then one of my favorite follows, not that Matt isn't, one of my favorite follows on Twitter, Patrick Everson of Covers, a senior writer there, covering everything you would need as a sports bettor. He joined me to talk about what he's seeing for this week's games, as well as a little bit of more inside baseball stuff on the sports betting industry. And with that, let's get right into it. Tim, you're going to give us a theme. We got a little bit of Denny Green on there. We got Bob Knight. One of my favorite parts of the show is listening to that theme every week. So Tim, go ahead and give us a drop.
Sports. The thrill of victory.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
The agony of defeat.
The Bears are who we thought they were.
Every loss teaches a lesson that's important for a young athlete's development.
I mean, I'm really disappointed in the progress that we've made.
But it's important to remember that sports is about having fun, not winning.
You're here for one goddamn specific reason.
What's that, Earl?
Jack us!
Ah, you're full of shit. Fuck you.
This is Moral Victories with Jared Shanker.
You really think I give a flying what the people on the radio call say?
And welcome, everybody, to episode number 8. Like alluded to in the intro, have Yankee tickets, and I'm getting out of here. It's about an hour before first pitch. It's on Tuesday, so very well the Yankees might be eliminated at this point, but we're going to rush over to the stadium, Doug and I, so we're going to get right into it this week. Follow me on Twitter for picks. It's at Jared_Shanker. You can follow the Moral Victories podcast on Twitter at Victories Moral, on Instagram at Moral Victories. And we're going to start the show by getting right into our interview with Matt Fortuna. And now joining me is Matt Fortuna, a college football writer for The Athletic. You can find him on Twitter at Matt_Fortuna. One of the first people before the influx of journalists that made it to The Athletic. You're one of the originals, right?
One of the original six writers. There are 8 of us on staff.
The original six.
I believe there are 34, including editors, for just college football. So things have changed a little bit in the past year, but they've changed for the better, that's for sure.
Yeah, as we record over Madison Square Garden, it's an honor to have another original six member on the podcast. And for those who don't know, before Matt joined The Athletic, and while I was still at ESPN, we were colleagues there. You go back a little bit further. We weren't roommates in college, but we were supposed to be roommates when we first joined ESPN. We were both going to be covering Ohio State. That didn't happen for reasons that we won't get into, but it left your pocket a little bit lighter. Almost lived together in college. You lived a floor above me, and I guess we'll save inside jokes so nobody else has to hear them. But luckily, you did live a floor above and not a floor under, because there was that time where I flooded 6 floors in the apartment complex.
Wow, that's the first I've heard of that. So
it was an impressive feat. I turned the tub on. There was a substance on my shirt. I won't get into what it was, and
yeah,
I was trying to.
The less we know, the better at that.
Yeah, I was trying to clean it off. I threw it in the tub, turned the faucet on, walked away, fell asleep for a good hour. And as I'm making my way back to the tub, about 10 feet before I got there, the carpet just sank and water just rose, and I knew I was in deep shit.
Oh, man.
2 seconds later.
Wow.
2 seconds later, someone's knocking on the door from the 5th floor, wondering why water is coming through their ceiling. The T-shirt had got sucked down the drain pretty much instantly, and it just flooded for a full 30 minutes.
You know, we had some pretty crazy war stories from the 11th floor there, but nothing to that nature. I forget where we went, because we were in the high rise, remember? That was like the skyscraper of State College, downtown State College.
12 floors.
12 floors, right, yeah. We were on the 11th. And my place was facing campus, But the night, I think it was during finals week, was the night Bin Laden got killed and everyone, as they do at Penn State, rioted and celebrated. And I went to, was it your apartment? It was someone else's apartment on the other side of that building where we had like a safe haven, or so we thought, just overlooking the chaos and the fireworks and everything else going on downstairs below us. And someone shot a firework that actually hit the bar of the terrace we were watching it from, and we almost got hit by it. So we almost had a JPP moment my last week of college there, but nothing that ended up affecting anyone five floors below me.
Yeah, that was a wild night. Couches were on fire. I don't think anything got overturned that night, but it's funny actually you mentioned JPP, because I did want to get your thoughts on this. You're a New York City guy. By the time this airs, the Yankees may or may not be out of the playoffs, and they're pretty much the one bright spot of the city. But you're a Giant fan, right?
I am. I mean, I'm so like detached and out of it on Sundays because I'm usually traveling, and I just kind of catch up on NFL and like nightly wrap up shows and stuff. But yes, I mean, I grew up going to games and was a diehard fan growing up, and I still follow them from afar.
What
I know they're not doing well.
No, they are not doing great. What'd you think of the whole Odell interview with Lil Wayne? I actually didn't see a ton of it. I saw how he called out the Giants for having a lack of heart and a lack of energy, which seems like a quick fix for Odell. He's familiar with powdery substances that help incite energy, so that feels like something that could easily be fixed on the team. But what did you think of him calling everybody out and just doing it right next to Lil Wayne?
Yeah, I did see the interview. I obviously heard about it from like everyone else in the last couple of days. And actually, a funny side note to that, which really brought it to my attention just a couple hours ago, earlier today, Lil Wayne apparently called out not just Eli Manning, but Frank Isola, now of The Athletic, for tweeting a joke about Lil Wayne interviewing Odell Beckham. So everyone has just become collateral with Odell Beckham.
Wow, he's coming at The Athletic Brotherhood. You guys got to rally around Frank.
I saw it because Frank retweeted a hip-hop site saying, "I'm tired of the hip-hop community constantly using my name to promote their work. Flattered, yes, but it's becoming exhausting." So that's where we are right now with the state of Odell on the 1-4 Giants. He got his money. It doesn't seem like his behavior's changed a whole lot. I can't say I'm surprised by that. I think there are a lot of other bigger issues as it relates to the actual football matters of the New York Giants than Odell Beckham running his mouth again and again. So that's where we are right now. I mean, the guy can't block for Eli Manning, and he can't defend against
he can throw.
Teams that have been lighting them up. He can throw. Yeah, we did notice that. Him and Hunter Renfrow this week both threw passes. Some of the more noticeable and more familiar wide receivers of this generation for me, covering a lot of Clemson and being a Giants fan. So that was interesting subplot for me to see over the past weekend. But
are the Pats going to use a first rounder on him? I feel like
they're. Of course they are, right?
Yeah, I feel like that's a given.
If not him, it's going to be Chris Fink on Notre Dame, another 5'9" white walk on, who's actually been very good for the Irish. But you know, he just fits that mold as well.
They should draft Justin Yoon, the all-time leading scorer in Notre Dame storied history, is now a kicker. That feels weird to say. Like I understand, like I know that most all-time scorers are kickers, but
right.
Like this is Notre Dame.
The guy he beat with Alan Pinkett, who was the running back and until last year was the radio analyst, really nice guy, who actually has a kid at Penn State now. There's a fun fact. But, yeah, I mean, it usually seems like kickers hold these records at every school. I think it was almost noticeable that the guy whose record he broke wasn't a kicker, which leads me to another point. Chris Hogan was at Penn State when we were there, except he wasn't playing football. How did that work out?
Did you know he played lacrosse? A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people don't know that he was a former lacrosse player.
Yeah, I don't think Joe Paterno and all the dead weight that was on that staff when we were there knew that either, because they had
the best receiver
on the team.
they had Larry Johnson. That's pretty much it.
Larry Johnson, but I mean, I was joking about this with Matt Brown, you know, our other former college classmate and one of my editors now. They won two Big Ten titles in a 4-year span there, despite having at least 30% of that staff never so much as lifting up a cell phone to recruit. I mean, that's kind of impressive in retrospect.
Yeah, actually, when you do put it that way, that half the staff was probably still using like singular wireless up until their final year there. That is impressive that they would have, that they even competed on that stage.
They probably had burner phones, but not in the way that other college recruiters have burner phones. So they were just paying by the month.
Yeah. Actually, wanted to get your take there. Penn State, Michigan. Penn State, Michigan State. I kind of think Penn State is poised to. It's 13.5. You know, I love my gambling, and that's one of the early games I'm looking at. I know you cover Notre Dame and you cover ACC, but you got your finger on the pulse everywhere. How do you see that one playing out this weekend?
Yeah, you know, on the surface, it seems like classic letdown, right? Just like it happened last year. They lose by 1 point to Ohio State, and they lose the next week to Michigan State. The fact that there's a bye in between, I think, gives them some chance to kind of, you know, turn the page, so to speak, get some closure with Ohio State and focus full speed ahead on Sparty. And the fact that Sparty just doesn't look good at all this year. I mean, that offense is atrocious.
They suck.
I thought they'd be a lot better. I mean, everything I had heard coming out of there this offseason, it was, you know, among the better receiving corps in the Big Ten. I really liked what I saw from Brian Lewerke last year. But I've also seen a lot of Northwestern this year. And if you're going to lose by double digits at home to Northwestern, which I think is what it was, a 39-29?
Yeah, 29-19.
Or 29-19, I'm sorry. That's not good. So that, the Arizona State loss, I just don't know what kind of team Mark D'Antonio has on his hands this year. I mean, I do know in a week or two, whenever they play Michigan, they'll get up for that one because that's just kind of like you could set your clock to it at this point. But other than that one, I'm not sure how good that team is. And that Penn State offense is still very, very explosive when they actually decide to put the ball in the hands of, you know, one of the better quarterbacks in the country, which I think they will get back to doing.
I don't know what you're talking about. We're going to gloss over that and quickly go. So, yeah, the Michigan State, I don't think they're clearly not going to be a factor in the Big Ten East. I don't think they're going to cover this weekend. I think what you saw against Northwestern is probably closer to what they're going to be for the rest of the year. I'm sure they'll play Michigan relatively tough, but I don't. I still think Michigan is clearly going to win that one. Ohio State probably.
My finger's not on the pulse from a Vegas perspective as close as yours is based on everything I've listened to from the Moral Victories podcast so far. But is it me or is it always just really tempting anytime you see a line that's like 13.5 or 6.5 or 20.5 to is that almost like a dare from Vegas to take the favorite? Because that's the way I see it from time to time.
Well, I try to find out where the best value is. So, like, I've stayed away from Alabama, and I think what's gotten lost is that Alabama hasn't covered in 3 weeks. They didn't cover against Texas A&M. They didn't cover against Louisiana.
I knew they would not against Louisiana. I couldn't tell you anything else about gambling this year, but them playing.
It's fear of missing out at this point for people who, like, the regular gambler. It's like, oh, I just want to take Alabama, or I just wanted to take the Patriots back in 2007. You're not getting any real value if you take Alabama at this point, even though they're far and away the best team in the country. They're probably going to easily win the national title game, barring a significant injury to Tua. They're probably going to beat every single team.
They'll probably still win it even if Tua gets hurt. I mean, they made it the last 2 years without him.
Yeah, that's true. The defense isn't great this year, and I think they can get exploited, but I also think they've just not been interested in these last few games. Missouri will be an interesting game. I think they're just about a 4-touchdown favorite, at least as of Tuesday. And Missouri can score the football. For as much as Missouri just embarrassed themselves against South Carolina this past weekend, Drew Locke is one of the better quarterbacks, and I think they can score. So I'm interested to see how they do this weekend. But last weekend, 8 of the top 25 lose. Other than Bama and Georgia, does everybody else just suck? I kind of feel like nobody else is really that good, and we probably say that every single year.
I feel like, you know, anytime you're filling out a ballot,
yeah.
Once you get to like through with the first month of the season, it's like, all right, here's my 1 through 4.
Bama just like,
I think I had Texas 6 this week. Like, do I think Texas is the 6th best team in the country? No.
Well, but they're back.
When I'm comparing them to everyone, like, they have a better argument than anyone. You know, I mean, wins over Oklahoma and TCU, like that's impressive. And USC, you know, I mean, they're not the USC of old, but you know, that's a quality non-conference blowout win at home as well. So to your point though, I mean there's, I think, what, 8 unbeaten power fives right now. I don't think anyone's taking NC State or Colorado seriously.
I resent that NC State look
the way
take.
We thought they look, although they did last week, and that's kind of been Clemson's MO the last couple of years: start slow, not be convincing, and then once they let Deshaun Watson run or Trevor Lawrence pass more or whatever it is their key to success is, they really start to take off and play their best ball down the stretch. But yeah, it certainly looks like Alabama. I would put Alabama in a league of its own, and then it's kind of like Georgia, Clemson, Ohio State, Notre Dame. And I don't even think Notre Dame's as good as those teams. But
should we be allowed to, if Notre Dame and Alabama are poised to match in a semifinal, I believe that us, the fan, should be allowed to vote Notre Dame out of Alabama-Notre Dame semifinal. Because,
well, the funny thing is, one of the semis this year is at the Orange Bowl, which is where that 2013 title game didn't happen, I should say. Notre Dame refuses to acknowledge it existed.
Well, technically, it never did happen, right?
Well, it's funny. They announced their two-game series with Alabama this spring, and in the press release, it says, like, Notre Dame is 6-1 all time against Bama, or whatever it is. The one loss coming in 1970, whatever. And I'm like, yeah,
I love college football. Is the only thing where you could get away with that. You can claim a national championship, maybe if you didn't even play football that year. But you could, like. I wonder who, like, there's some team that claims the 1776 National Championship trophy, but only in college football could you say, well, because that game had to be vacated because a player cheated on a test, that it never happened.
I talked to people from Notre Dame when it happened. I'm like, all right, what are you trying to pull here? Like, what's going on? And the explanation that was given to me was essentially the NCAA rules when it comes to this stuff is you vacate all regular season wins in bowl appearances. And so the school takes it as if the game never happened, then the loss couldn't have happened. And they claim to have reached out to the NCAA for clarity on that and never got any clarity. And so that's what they went with. Same as USC with Texas to the Rose Bowl at the end of the 2005 season. So yeah, there's a lot of creative accounting that comes with this. I mean, I've been at Notre Dame's old post-game interview room before they renovated the stadium. They would have kind of group team photos decorated throughout the lounge there. And I believe the 93 one, when they lost, when they beat Florida State, but Florida State won the national title, I believe they had one that said 1993 national champions in there to show recruits. So, yeah, I, among a number of other reasons, I have no problem with UCF claiming the national championship from last season. And if they run the table again this year, they could be back-to-back champs.
They're technically not. Somebody actually did name them national championship, some poll that nobody's ever heard of.
I believe it was the Massey poll, which also has Notre Dame number one right now, if I'm not mistaken. So
that's an interesting poll. Is it just one person?
I wish I was better versed in like BCS lingo so I could
can we come up with a poll?
Let's just get our friend David Hale on the line. I mean, he's crunched more numbers than any of these guys.
He doesn't do rankings, he does tiers. There's a big difference. And I'll be sure to send this to let him know that we're busting his balls. But
you have it no other way.
Exactly. So eight of the top 25 lose were pretty much, it feels like, a Bama Georgia rematch, but even Georgia's still looking suspect. But you give
they gotta get through Death Valley this week. I mean, it's not nothing.
I don't think that's gonna be. It's not nothing, but it is pretty close to it.
Because I'm joining Jared Chinger's podcast, I'm thinking of it in Vegas terms. 7.5 is a little high in my opinion to go there. I wouldn't put my money on LSU because I just don't trust Ed Orgeron with my money. But that's a lot of points to give in that environment. And I just think it's a cumulative thing of Georgia still having to play Kentucky and Florida and some other teams that, probably aren't real threats, but are a lot better and can't be taken for granted the way I think a lot of us thought they'd be able to coming into the season.
No, they haven't looked great. I honestly don't think they have any real shot of losing this weekend. 7.5, that half point makes me potentially stay away. I think LSU can keep it close because that defense is so good. And in big games in Death Valley, Orgeron does such a good job. But I honestly don't think they have really any chance of winning. I said last week I saw Virginia Tech having almost, no, not almost, they had zero shot of beating Notre Dame. I didn't really care about how they looked the week before beating Duke. And I, like, even what I saw from LSU last week doesn't really change my opinion. I think we know what LSU is, and is that they are going to be very good on defense, and it's going to keep them in games, but against truly elite competition, and Miami is not that, and even Florida is not that, that they're just outmatched. And even in these last few years against Alabama, even if it's a 10-point or a 14-point game, they've always felt like so much further than that. And I kind of see this Georgia game being very similar in that regard, where maybe the end score is 27. No, LSU's not scoring 20 without a defensive touchdown. It might be like 21-14, and there's no point in the game where you actually feel that Georgia is in a position to lose.
There's just nothing. I mean, picture how hopeless it was to watch those offenses in years past, and that was with a Leonard Fournette, a Darius Geis, a home run, first-round NFL talent.
Zach Mettenberger was an NFL starter, too. Don't sully the good name of Zach Mettenberger.
How dare I? They don't have that this year, right? So Joe Burrow's been, I mean, until last week he was mistake-free, which I guess is, you know, a compliment. but there's just nothing. I think you hit the nail on the head. There's no point where I watch those games. And yes, even late against Florida, I tweeted when they threw the pick six at the end, you know, this might be a positive play for them because they're getting the ball back, still down 8 with better field position, and they get a new set of downs. Like that's how like hopeless I felt about that team when they're in like a 3rd and long position.
I said that to my brother. Nothing. I was like, this actually, you know, if LSU had an offense, this actually works out way better for them. And then I was like but they also have no chance of driving 75 yards for a game-winning touchdown.
Like, you can't get mad at the Florida kid for returning it, but, like, I'm like,
oh, hell, I would have done the same thing.
The game's over, you know?
Even if I knew that I take a knee and the game's over, I'm scoring if I'm that guy. I respect the hell out of what he did.
I don't blame him. That's what I'm saying, but, same wavelength here. I mean, there's nothing inspiring about that offense. It's been that way for as long as we can remember. And I just don't see that changing. And again, it's going to hurt them when they play the Georgias and Bamas of the world, unless they come up with, you know, a pick six or some kind of game breaking play, and then don't negate that offensively with a negative play of their own. I think that's pretty much their only shot. It gives them a puncher's chance in a lot of these games. They'll probably cover more often than not, but to truly break through and beat a top 5 program like that, I have a hard time seeing it happening.
Yeah, and you mentioned really briefly Kentucky, but I think they might be the one team I'm rooting most for this year. I don't think they're really good either, and they're 5-1, I believe, and they're probably going to end up like 8-4 or something like that. They're going to be out of the top 25 soon, but I respect the hell out of any team that can go to overtime and never run an offensive play in opponent's territory. And it's very Jimbo Fisher-like, having watched some of those offenses operate at Florida State my last few years down there. It seems very Jimbo-like, and I think he's a really good coach, but very Jimbo-like to even go to overtime against a team that didn't run a single play in Texas A&M territory until the ref spotted the ball with 25 yards to go.
Did you cover Stoops when he was at DC there?
I did not. He left after 2012 to take the Kentucky job. I have spoken to Mark a few times though.
Yeah, it wasn't a great weekend for that family. I'll say that much. But I mean, I like Kentucky. I think more than other people do. I mean, again, maybe this was poor coaching by Jimbo Fisher, but to take a team to overtime without crossing midfield and basically completely abandoning maybe the best running back in the country. Bold strategy, if you ask me, but like they still got to overtime somehow. By the way, you want to talk about a bad beat? I'll just say a friend of mine really liked Kentucky at +6 that game because he thought Kentucky was going to win and he missed kickoff. So he got it live at +4 and ended up losing in overtime. Like,
ooh,
that kind of sucks. But that's neither here nor there. I still think Benny Sells phenomenal, and that's still one of the best rushing offenses in the country. I mean, they ran for like 300-something yards on Florida. Like, that wasn't a fluke. These Kentucky wins have not been a fluke. I would argue their loss this past week by not crossing the 50-yard line in regulation was more of a fluke than anything else. So I think that's a team that can make some noise. I think they can win 10 games this year. I really do. They'll lose to Georgia, but I mean, looking at that schedule now, they're not going to lose to Louisville. They might lose to Mizzou. They're not going to lose to Tennessee. I see one more loss on that schedule, barring an injury to Benny Snell. I think that's a really good football team.
Wow. And their fans are ridiculous. So once they hear this, you're going to have like 30,000 new BBN followers, Big Blue Nation. I hope you know
do
that.
Do they have 30,000 football fans there? I thought.
Well, you just lost them. You just lost every single one of them.
I mean,
you mentioned Oklahoma firing Mike Stoops. Is your boy Bob Diaco positioned to be the new defensive coordinator at Oklahoma? God, I want
that
to happen.
I was laughing too hard over your question.
What's Bob Diaco's points per game defense going to be? Like, I'm thinking 15 to 16 points per game of a Diaco-run Oklahoma defense.
Hey, Ruffin McNeil is defense coordinator there. All right, let's get that straight, first off. Bob just got promoted to, I think, outside or inside linebackers coach from his analyst position.
I actually had no idea that he's even officially staffed now.
Yeah. No, they made Ruffin the interim DC.
That's disappointing. He seems like one of the best guys in college football, but
Ruffin, yeah, everyone loves him.
Unfortunately for him, everybody wanted to see Diaco get it for our own purposes.
No, we want to see it for entertainment standpoint. I don't know if both Oklahoma fans want to see that.
I wonder who like their new rival is going to be. Like he's going to build the trophy against Kansas State. just take on Snyder.
How do you top the civil conflict? Like what? Where do you even begin? Maybe he does. He's an Iowa guy, so maybe he starts one against Iowa State since they played two close games the last 2 years. I don't know.
Well, that'll have to be the first question. Once somebody talks to him, that's going to be the first question. I kind of feel bad for him now at this point because everybody wants to talk about the civil conflict trophy, but.
I mean, we could do a whole podcast on other Bob Diaco stories if you really want to open this up to the floor here. Civil conflict doesn't even scratch the surface of some of the funny stories we had from the Notre Dame covering that guy.
Give me the best one, because now you can't just tease it and then not
give you a great one. And the best part about this one is it happened twice. So Pete Sampson, who's now a colleague of mine at The Athletic, used to be at Irish
obviously.
Illustrated along with Tim O'Malley, obviously. Tim O'Malley is at Irish Illustrated. We'll start with Tim O'Malley. Keep in mind, I was not here to see these happen, but they've both repeated these stories so many times that they've become kind of like lore in the Notre Dame beat. So national title games that never happened against Alabama. They had their media day at, I believe it was called Sun Life Stadium at the time, and that was one of the few times we were able to talk to assistants. And Tim O'Malley had relayed this story to us afterward about how Bob's sitting in the stands and Tim goes up to him and, they're chit-chatting for a little bit. How you doing? How's life? Blah, blah, blah. And Tim, I believe his wife had just had a kid. And so he said, we just had a kid, and Bob's congratulating him. And the way Tim describes it is clearly it's a filibuster. Like, Bob Diaco just does not care for the media. Like, he's a nice guy, but like, he's never going to divulge anything. He doesn't want to talk to us. Like, that's fine. I get it. But Bob apparently then starts telling Tim about the importance of breastfeeding to keep the kid from crying at night. And so Tim relays a story to a bunch of us later that night at the hotel and over a couple of beers, and we're just dying. And we can't believe it. Like, we can because it's Diaco, but like, we're laughing so hard. Like, you got to be making this up. And fast forward to the following season's preseason media day. In the Notre Dame Stadium press box, a couple of us are walking out, and Pete Sampson, who also just had a kid that summer, shares an elevator with Bob Diaco, and Pete relays the exact same conversation. How you doing? Just had a kid. Oh, I got to tell you, man, your wife has to breastfeed. That's going to keep the kid from crying all night. So Bob ended up leaving after that season to go become the head coach at UConn. And so Sampson, I think to this day, says, I hope I never talk to him again, just so I can say my last conversation with him was about breastfeeding, which again was not unique to anyone on that Notre Dame beat, because he had that same conversation with another writer before. So that's just a little taste, I think, of Bob Diaco. He is a different cat. He's
big breastfeeding guy. Very natural.
He was a phenomenal coordinator at Notre Dame, and even at UConn, I think some of the stuff he said publicly took away from the fact that he made that a bowl team in 2 years and really turned that defense around. I know a lot of people who have worked with him in the past, and they speak very highly of the work he did behind the scenes to get that program kind of on stable ground. And we've seen it all crumble since he left with Ernie Edsall taking over. But he's a different dude, to put it lightly.
Handsome dude as well.
Did you wake up today thinking you were going to have me on your podcast talking about the benefits of breastfeeding?
I actually did. I dreamt about it. Okay. I have very lucid dreams. I'm going to get myself in trouble if I go down this road.
Great head of hair.
He does. He does. The nicest thing anyone's ever said to me was David Hale tweeted me out of nowhere one time saying he envied my hair. And
wow.
Yeah, that really.
Well, people said that to me when I was like a kindergartner and I looked like Ronald McDonald with my red afro, but they have not said that to me since I like basically became a teenager.
I'm going to edit that out. So nobody's going to hear that part where you subtly make fun of telling me that it might not have been as genuine as I believe it to be. So now I'm going to kick you off. But before, give me the new four for the playoff. When I had you on before, you told me Wisconsin. I laughed.
And then everyone else stole my pick, and I jumped off the bandwagon because it got way too heavy.
Oh, so now you're claiming that you actually dropped Wisconsin before the season? Is that what I'm hearing?
No, but I remember you laughing at me when I said Wisconsin, and August comes around, and every outlet in the world's writing about these guys as the next big thing, and then they have, a scandal there and a couple suspensions, and I'm just like, this is bad news. Like, this is – I don't like – I believe preseason vibes and mojo was very real. And I hated the mojo around Wisconsin because every single person in the world was calling them a contender, a ship I had kind of started myself back in January after the Orange Bowl.
Take credit for that.
It just got a lot of – it got way too credit for me.
So who's the four now?
Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, who I still think – I think they could lose a game still. I'm not sold on that defense, especially that secondary, but they're basically going to have to lose two games, I think, to not win the Big Ten. Everything points to Notre Dame, and yet I feel like so jaded having covered these guys and seen them have so many November letdowns.
All right, give me a dark horse then. Give me somebody that not a lot of people are talking about, but has a legitimate chance.
I think Texas has a chance, but they're not going to do it.
Oh, I love that.
They're not.
Texas is back.
Can I say West Virginia? They're still undefeated. No.
Okay. All right. No, I like that. I like West Virginia. I think that's a good one. We'll wrap up on that one.
I can't get past that Merrill Moss. They barely beat Tulsa. I mean, there's a lot of flaws on that team. Like, credit them for having the breakthrough win and looking good so far. But like, I don't know. The Big 12 is going to be the most fun race to watch because, assuming it's a three team race between those three, they're all going to beat each other, and then two of them are going to play each other again in the Big 12 title game and maybe conspire to keep the league out of the playoff altogether. I just think that's going to be a fascinating theater the rest of the way.
It would be a very Big 12 thing for them to knock themselves out of the playoff. But Matt, as always, I always appreciate you coming on and kicking it with us for a little while. And I'll have you back on before the playoff, man, for sure.
Thank you. Hopefully all my picks, whoever they were, I can't even keep track of them at this point.
I don't think we actually established who your fourth pick was. We're going to give you West Virginia, though.
But okay, we'll go with West Virginia. And hopefully the Yankees are still playing by the time this thing airs, although I'm a little down after last night.
Yeah, it was ugly. But hey, man, we'll talk soon.
Anytime, brother.
Cool. Before we get to our interview with Patrick Everson at Covers, I want to talk to you about MyBookie.net. Sports fans, football season's here and it's time to get in on the action with MyBookie.net. MyBookie.net is the industry-leading sports action website that offers real Vegas odds on football, baseball, and all your favorite sporting events. You can take a side, the total, or you can even bet the over-under on how many fantasy points a player will score. MyBookie.net lets you play online and win big. Use promo code VICTORIES when you register for your account and get a 100% sign-up bonus. Did the game kick off? Don't sweat it. MyBookie.net has in-game live action on every major league event, even esports. There's no better time to join MyBookie.net than today. Go to MyBookie.net to open an account and start winning. Use promo code VICTORIES when you register for your account and get a 100% sign-up bonus. Get in on the action. Visit MyBookie.net's website today and use promo code VICTORIES and get your 100% sign-up bonus. MyBookie.net, promo code VICTORIES for a 100% bonus. No deposit necessary. Terms and conditions apply. For entertainment purposes only, void where prohibited. And now let's get to our interview with Patrick Everson. And now joining me is Patrick Everson, senior writer at Covers. It's a go-to source for sports bettors, of which I am. Everybody knows that. On Twitter, you can follow him at Covers_Vegas. That's at Covers_Vegas. Patrick, how are things going out there?
Things are phenomenal. This is the greatest time of year. It is literally the most wonderful time of the year as far as sports betting goes, with football season fully entrenched. We're into October now, and it's fantastic. It's busy. It's crazy nuts, but it's definitely the best time of year to be covering this industry.
As it's gotten more mainstream, sports betting, the public perception on it has changed so much over just the last 18 months, 2 years, whatever it is, for a confluence of reasons. But it's generally more accepted now. A lot more people are doing it. How have you seen the sports books change, at least the environment of being in a sports book on a football weekend over these last, 2-3 years?
Well, in Vegas, it's probably about the same because it's always been here.
Yeah.
But it's been really interesting to, I spent a little bit of time in New Jersey right after the decision came down in May from the Supreme Court and New Jersey legalized. I spent some time there in June when they first got it off the ground. And then I was in New Jersey for a week, that first full week of NFL. And it's just amazing. It's really neat to see how quickly it's come together for these places and how, the vibe is translated. It's not necessarily exactly the same vibe as Vegas because they're still kind of getting their bearings and I don't want to say figuring out what's going on. It's not like people don't know what's up. A lot of them very much know what's up. But there are some who are a little new to it, and it's a little different for them. And maybe, I think as one person put it when I was out in New Jersey this past time, it's been going on in Vegas so long that when you come here, it's kind of part of the entertainment experience.
Mm-hmm.
And because that Vegas is a destination, not just for sports betting, but for a whole lot of stuff. Whereas at some of the spots in New Jersey, it's not necessarily a destination. You're going there to bet, and you're expecting to win money, and you're not kind of counting it. You don't really feel like it's an entertainment expense. You almost feel like if I don't win, I'm not happy. So I'm hoping that everybody kind of adapts from the newcomers kind of adapt to that and understand. Look, this is a lot of fun. Have some fun with it. Keep yourself within reasonable limits and treat it as entertainment, that you'll be entertained for a few hours and maybe you'll win a few bucks and maybe you won't.
Very, very shocked, and as a New Jersey native, very shocked and disappointed that you would call Atlantic City not exactly a destination town outside of its gambling enterprises.
Oh, no. I don't mean it like that.
No, I'm just joking.
Not everybody's running to Monmouth to do this, which I understand. It's a different atmosphere there. Atlantic City, and that's the thing, though. This is something that's going to change in time. You've got the great new book at the Ocean, which is amazing. I'm telling you, if you drop that book in Las Vegas, that is a top five sports book right now. Hands down, no question. Maybe even higher than top five. Borgata is going to have its own sportsbook space in due time, and I know that MGM is not going to, dial that down at all. They're going to make it nice. And I haven't been in all the other spots yet, but I've seen some photos and so forth. There's a few other properties there that are doing some neat things. So don't take that too much the wrong way. I just, Vegas, everybody comes here for a whole lot of different things. And as you're getting adjusted to that in New Jersey, I think you're getting You're getting some of that crowd. You're getting a lot of guys who really have bet for a long, long time, some really sharp people who have done this in a variety of ways, without casting any aspersions here. They've managed to sports bet in a variety of ways, and now are under the the legal and regulatory guidance of the state of New Jersey. So they certainly know what's going on, and they understand what to expect. And I think as more and more people understand the entertainment value, just treat it as, hey, instead of I spent, $40 on a movie ticket and dinner and a drink tonight, I put together a three-teamer and had a couple of beers and maybe a pizza, and I might not get my money back, but that's my entertainment tonight. You know what I mean?
Oh, exactly. And for me, thankfully, I've been off to a really good start this year. I think I'm 24-12. I mostly just do college and NFL. And if I'm bored, well, now that college football, we're recording this on Tuesday, college football midweek action is back. So sometimes I'd get in on basketball or baseball if I was just a little bored during the week. But now that Maxion and all that's back, I'll probably just get back to that. But yeah, it is sort of an entertainment thing where if you only lose $30 on a weekend, as well, you had maybe 8 hours or so of fun. You're hanging with a couple friends. Like I said, maybe having a few beers. You win a game, you lose two, and you end up down whatever, something in your limits. It is that entertainment thing, but you kind of touched on it there. Is it? You've been covering this for a while. You've been out in Vegas for a while. Now, if you're given, what's a piece of advice you might give for some of the noob gamblers out there that are just starting to dip their toes into it?
Well, it's right on that. It's remembering that for most people, sports betting is relatively, most people are betting relatively limited amounts of money. And so you don't treat it as, make sure you treat it as the entertainment that it is. Have fun with it. If you happen to come out ahead, if you happen to go 2-1 every week for several weeks and you're making money, fantastic. But if you go 1-2 or dump a few 0-3s out there, but as you said, you got to hang with your buddies all day watching football at the sports book at the Ocean or Monmouth or up at the FanDuel spot up in the Meadowlands or Borgata or wherever. You got to spend a day, have a good time. Maybe you got a few free drink tickets for your bets, hopefully. Just don't get carried away. Treat it like entertainment. Now, there are, for those who are, really intrigued by trying to do more than that, well, I would just recommend that you study hard. You really absorb as much information as you can. If you want to try to be a bit more of a serious bettor, you've really got to, study money management methods and really know your P's and Q's on injuries and stats and trends and coaching tendencies and player tendencies and weather and all these things that you really have to think about a lot if it's something where you're like, okay, I'm doing this to make money. If you are, then you need to have a level of seriousness that is accordingly appropriate.
Yeah, I think you're 100% dead on there. I think most of the the Joes just, they want to get in on it. They'll probably, maybe they take a team like Alabama that's a 30-point road favorite, and kind of a they see Alabama crushing everybody week to week, but then they're not really aware that Alabama hasn't covered 3 weeks in a row, and as awesome as they are, it's kind of been taken into account at the sports books, and there's kind of that, you're paying a premium if you want to take Alabama at this point. I think that's maybe for a lot of the new bettors, they kind of don't pick up on some of the tendencies like that.
Right. They may not be paying attention to that. They just know that Alabama is incredible and that they, what they ought to be looking at, seriously, if you're looking at Alabama right now, bet the first half.
That's what everybody is talking about. And you got the ones who did got a little lucky last week. This is like a 66-yard touchdown just before the half to finally get past that number.
Yeah, but yeah, take a look at some of those other things. And even if you're just having fun with it, still, it doesn't hurt to do a little bit of research. And if you're, like I said, if you just do even a little modicum of research, get on Twitter a little bit, get on covers.com or there's certainly other outlets, but I obviously believe Covers has got more information than anybody else.
No, you guys do an awesome job.
Yeah, just see if you can spot a couple of interesting trends that kind of support what you feel is the right way to go in a game. And it doesn't always have to be the whole game. Maybe it's the first half. Maybe it's the second half. Maybe you sit tight, see how the game, you want to be in on a certain game, but you just don't have a good feel. Well, watch the first 5 or 10 minutes and see if you can get a feel for something and then jump in on it on a mobile app on the in-game.
Yeah.
There's just so many ways to do it, even for the casual bettors. where you can have a good time at it, and it doesn't always have to be a bet you make before kickoff.
One of the big things I like to do is to do a second half fade. I think people, even whether it's week to week or even drive to drive, there's that recency bias. And say an over under is set at 70, and they hit close to 50 in the first half. Obviously, not every single time is it gonna reverse trend and be lower in the second half. But a lot of times, you know, it's just kind of the mean of regression. They kind of come back a little bit, and you're closer to that number. So that's another one that I kind of tell new people to look into is just because something happened over the first half doesn't mean it's necessarily going to carry over. And if you get maybe an extra 2 or 3 points in that second half line that you wouldn't have got normally, it's worth taking that second half bet.
Oh, absolutely. If you get a first half over, taking a second half under, something like that, I think that's I think there's something to that. And even occasionally to the vice versa, if teams were expected to get off to kind of a good start and somehow it's just a slow first half, you know, maybe take the other side of that. But yeah, I think there's things you can do there. Like I said, even as a public bettor, a casual bettor, just trying to have fun out with his buddies, you know, keep an eye on some of that in-game, some of that halftime stuff. Sometimes there's ways you can get a little more value there than you could get pre-kickoff.
And we touched on Alabama just real briefly, but curious, from your conversations with people out there in the desert, what's been, I don't know if it tougher is the right word, but how have they kind of approached, what's maybe been tougher between setting a line for Bama this year versus New England back in 2007, where sometimes it doesn't really seem like the number can be high enough for one to get people to take the underdog, or two to find a number that they're not going to cover.
Well, I was actually going back and forth on this with Tony DiTomaso, who is the risk he manages risk for CG Technology Books out here in Vegas. And you know, for those who don't know, CG Technology takes they're a book that takes a lot of sharper play. They kind of cater to the sharper players, so. It's a real challenge, the role that Tony is in, you know, under those circumstances. But he's been around the industry for a long, long time. Well, you know, he was, you know, with other entities before CG. So he's familiar with both of these situations, say the 2007 Patriots and the current Alabama. What he had to say to me is, and it's a quote from him, the Bama team of today is tough. They score 3 to 4 touchdowns in 8 minutes. And he intimated that that's something that's so hard to counter for, to plan for as you're setting odds. So I think his lean would be that it would be a little tougher on Alabama because they're just scoring so many points. I mean, even when the Patriots in 2007 were getting those big point spreads, it wasn't like they were favored by 21 or anything crazy like that. Maybe there was a game or two that got in that realm. I'd have to go back and look, but. I mean, look, Alabama is 25, 30, 35, 40. I mean, it's almost incalculable. So I think he sees today's challenge of Bama 2018 a little bit more difficult. But again, as you pointed out earlier, that might relate to some of that recency bias as well. It's been a long time since 2007.
Let's do the other side of the coin. Last year, a lot of the sharps were on the Browns just because they were so bad, but there was so much value because of just because of how bad they were. They hadn't won in forever. One in 15 in 2016, obviously winless as they went through the campaign last year. How have you seen that flip this year, if you have, as far as how people are viewing the Browns through this you know, a little bit of a resurgence? They're 2-2-1 and
right.
Actually look pretty good.
Right. It's a little bit back and forth. There's been a couple weeks this season where the books have needed the Browns, and there's been a couple weeks this season where they've definitely needed the other side. This past weekend, they actually needed the Browns, and that's generally how it's been the last couple of years. Sharp money has been on the Browns, but it hasn't been to the point that it's outweighed the public money coming in against them because they've just been so terrible. And honestly, their spread record was not a whole lot better than their regular record, even their straight-up record, even though sharp money was on the Browns. So as this past weekend, it got to the point, at least with MGM Books, which is one of the books I spoke with about that specific game, the Browns and the Ravens, where one of my contacts there, he said, look, we're finally getting back to normal here. We actually need the Browns this week, and they got them. So they were certainly grateful for that. They had some large wagers come in on the Ravens. So it's been a little back and forth here as people try to figure out, okay, what are the Browns? Are they actually not awful? And they're not. I mean, they're, look, they're not. I think they're 4-1 against the number. So they're the best spread cover, one of the best spread covering teams through the first few weeks.
Yeah, I think the only one undefeated is the Chiefs at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And the Rams would have been, but couldn't hold it up against Seattle. So yes, they're. I think it's a little bit of a challenge for the books in that sense, but they have needed the Browns in the past, siding with the Sharps, and they certainly needed them this past week. But again, it's been a little back and forth this season. I think we'll have to wait a couple more weeks before we can. The jury's still out on that, I guess, is a good way to put it.
Yeah, I was one of the people against the Browns this week. I had taken the Ravens, and there's sometimes nothing more, I don't know if anxious-ridden or just absolutely frustrating than betting on Joe Flacco sometimes. The red zone the red zone pick there, they throw it 56 times, and he's never in a rhythm at any point. The Ravens in general can be one of those teams where even though they're favored, a lot of times you just have to hold your breath taking them because they're one of those teams where you just don't ever know what's going to happen. And that's probably more of a product of Flacco than anything else there.
Yeah, really. I wouldn't disagree with that. And it's strange. I mean, and you're exactly right. I mean, what was the final score? Was 12-9 last
12-9.
Week? Is that right?
Yep.
I mean, 12-9. I mean, come on. It's so. You see the Ravens sometimes put up, 25, 30 points and then go out and, barely scratch, can't even scratch double digits. It just seems improbable. It's so hard to measure Flacco from week to week. So generally speaking, like in the Super Contest, for example, I don't think I took Baltimore at all last year, and I don't think I've taken them so far through 5 weeks this year, and I'm not going to start.
How you doing in the Super? That's for ones who don't follow Super closely. It's the contest held out by the Westgate. You got to pick five teams every week. They do it over the entire course of the season. I know going into last weekend, I think the leader was at either 17-3 or 16-4. How are you looking? Yeah, that's insane to be 17-3.
I'm just above 500, but that is a lot better than I was after 2 weeks. I'll tell you, I was horrible the first 2 weeks. I got a few unlucky bounces. I mean, some reasonable picks, but just. It's really hard to pick five games against the spread every week. You can maybe isolate one or two, maybe three, but boy, when you try to get to five, it gets hard.
So, exactly.
But the last 3 weeks, I'm 10-4-1. I threw a 5-0 out there, then a 3-2.
Now we're talking.
Then a 3-2, and then this past week I snuck out a 2-2-1. I got the Texans. Fortunately, got me a push in that Sunday night game to salvage a 500 week for me. So that's got me at least above the waterline. I'm above 500. I'm sitting somewhere around 1,100th out of 3,100, 3,200 players. And I was at 2,900th after week two. So I'm up almost 2,000.
Oh, there you go.
Spots.
Yeah,
I'm
you're
2,000 spots in the last 3 weeks. So I feel a little better.
Yeah, you're hot right now. Yeah, but the NFL, I usually keep it to, at least when I give out my plays on Twitter, usually it's about three games. And
sure.
I picked the three wrong ones this week. I had Pittsburgh, and obviously they covered, but then Baltimore, and actually like Jacksonville. But the ones that I didn't play that I put out there that I was leaning, they all hit. I liked Seattle. I liked Arizona. I liked Detroit and Buffalo. And, of course, but with the NFL, you don't want to stretch yourself too thin on any given Sunday just because things can – I forgot where I read this, but years ago, it's a four-minute game. Almost every NFL game comes down to those final 4 minutes – where one bounce of the ball and it completely flips your Sunday. And if you get two or three of those and you take seven games, man, you just whatever you might have made on Saturday is just wiped out.
No question. I mean, I'm looking at my ticket from last week at the Super Contest, and I had Chiefs, Dolphins, Eagles, Seahawks, Texans. Dolphins, I mean, that was a slam dunk play. They were up 17-0, and they were getting 6.5 points, and then they didn't score the rest of the game. I mean, they did not score the rest of the game. So, but in looking at those picks, the two that I felt the strongest about, no question, were the Chiefs only having to lay three at home, and the Seahawks getting seven against the Rams. I just felt like the Rams were going to have a little regression to the mean, even if they won the game, which
of course
they did. So I felt great about those. I felt decent about the Dolphins. I wasn't sure about the Eagles or Texans, but I thought laying three, let's hope I can get a push out of either one of those.
Yeah.
And I ended up getting a push out of one. But as you said, if I only had to make three, it would have been Chiefs, Seahawks, and one other, and I would have went 2-1. But boy, you try to go to five, or like you said, six or seven, and it's like, oh my goodness, this is hard. It's really hard.
Yeah, that's what I like. I always advise people to, if you want to play a parlay, maybe throw $5 on there. Just to have a little bit of fun. Or one thing that I like to do is I'll take three small underdogs on the money line and parlay it. And if you hit one of those every few weeks, more than every few weeks, if you can hit two of those over the course of the season, you're probably pretty good. So that's
right.
But how often are people asking you? I know you cover a lot of the sort of like maybe that for a general person will be considered inside baseball type stuff. But how often are people asking you for plays when you're out there on Twitter, on sports? Yeah, that's what I figured. And then how many people want to talk to you about their bad beat?
Oh, they definitely want to talk about that, and they probably, you're going to remember those. You're going to remember those tough losses more than you're going to remember the wins. You just never. I feel like you.
Marshall Pitt. I already have mine. Marshall Pittsburgh. I think it was 2015 or 2016. I had Marshall as like a 16-point underdog, and there's I think 2 seconds left on the clock. They're down 14 or something. They're in their own, maybe their own 20, and instead of just running out the clock, they decide to throw it. It's a pick six. Pittsburgh scores a touchdown, and Marshall no longer covers. So we tend to remember some of those plays.
Yeah, those ones sting the most, and that's the one that people tend to bring up the most when they're recounting them with me. But they also remember the really good sweats that came out on the right side, where it was really like, oh, my goodness, am I going to get this? Am I going to get this? So it's a little bit of both, but certainly people are you're never going to forget the losses, because that sting just stays with you like it did with you on that Marshall Pitt game.
What's the baddest beat you've ever seen? I know you might have to rack your brain a little bit. Anything jump out to you?
Well, I'll tell you that's why I make it a point now every Monday night during football season to watch Scott Van Pelt, man. Oh my gosh, it's just crushing to watch some of those, because you know often he'll find them in games that are a little bit obscure that you may not have seen. And I got to tell you, last night, I don't know if you saw last night, but last night may have been an all-timer. I'll relay it for those who didn't see it, but University of California Davis was playing Northern Colorado. I think those are both FCS teams, but some of the FCS games do get put up on the board here in Vegas. And UC Davis was up 49-10 in the fourth quarter. They were up by 39 points. They were favored by 13.5. And Northern Colorado covered. They scored a ton of points. But the final score was 49-36. You lost by the hook in like the last minute. And I've never seen anything like that. I mean, I've seen some crazy stuff on that segment on SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt and Stanford Steve. And I've seen a couple things in the sports book in my time for sure. But that just, I just can't believe that you're up by 39 and you lose that bet by the hook. And somebody, and you know somebody bet it. Somebody
oh, of course.
You know?
What's the, see for, again, for those who don't follow gambling super closely, there's been a lot of fun going around on the social webs, on the interwebs, about the, I don't know what they're officially calling him, the duffel bag gambler or...
Yeah, the duffel bag better.
Yeah, just walking around with duffel bags full of cash and parlaying pretty much the biggest favorites every single week. I know he had Ohio State like given 35 or so week one, along with Wisconsin given about 38 or so.
Right.
What's been the... It might not be him, but give me some of the... maybe one of the more crazy plays you've seen somebody make. They don't have to have hit it. Yeah, like duffel bag guy. I don't know if he's hit any of these big ones yet, but
right.
What's been some of the crazier ones?
He's definitely taking a bath, putting six figures out there, or at least mid five figures on you know three and four and five.
It gets so mad. I get so mad just thinking that somebody has the money to just do stuff like that.
But, it's a little frustrating. I can understand.
Yeah,
but it's interesting on my end. It's great copy for me.
Content, baby.
Great content, no question. But. He actually did pretty good last weekend. I don't know if from what I heard, I did not hear that he weighed in Sunday, but he did a two-teamer and a four-teamer on Saturday, and he's also starting to pile on to whoever is playing Rutgers. And finally this Saturday, that paid off for him. He had a two-teamer and a four-teamer, and he hit them both. So he made a good chunk of the money he's lost. He made a good chunk back this past weekend, but he's definitely had a little bit of rough sledding on it. How about this guy from a couple of weeks ago? They've got kind of another new guy who's been around this season, and he seems a little bit sharper, and he's been playing a lot of six-figure bets on the money line and on the point spread. He'll take a team on both, and he'll lay out six figures on both. And two weekends ago, he had Titans and Texans both as dogs, both against the spread, both on the money line, six figures all the way around, and in some cases multiple bets on numbers. And they both win in outright in overtime. So he did. He lost a couple of bets that weekend too, but he had more laid into those two teams and those two games than anything else. So he cleaned up pretty good. But as far as crazy, one of the best ones I've seen this season. I think it was two weekends ago. I can't recall exactly who Alabama was playing that weekend, but somebody went into the South Point and made a $1,600 money line bet on Alabama, and Alabama was favored by like 40 or whatever. So it was $1,600 to win like literally $3 or something. And I think he just did it to have a ticket in his hand, and by making a $1,600 bet, he probably got a ton of drink tickets, and he just drank all afternoon and watched football all day. So good on him, but I thought that was hilarious.
Speaking of something like that, was it Albany that beat Virginia? And I saw a couple people had Albany money line. Did that ever get cash? I know there was talk of maybe the better just framing it, and maybe you don't know, but
You mean back in the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, back in March.
No, it was Vermont.
Vermont.
Yeah, I did the story on him. I saw him make the bet because I was with him when he made the bet, just coincidentally. He and his buddies, it's a group from Alabama, and they come up here two, three times a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten to be pretty good friends with them. I see him pretty regularly. So we connected a couple of times during the first 4 days of the NCAA tournament. And they felt, his whole group, they felt really, really good about that bet. A couple of them had money line. He had it for the biggest amount, and then they also took him against the spread. They just felt like, they analyzed it a lot. They understand that Virginia tends to slow down on offense, and if somehow they ended up being behind at all, it's often hard for them to overcome any deficit because of the type of style of basketball they play. So they actually, it wasn't so much as much of a flyer as you might have thought.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I was with him when he made the bet, and immediately after the game, he and I got together. I took a picture with the ticket and everything, and he was like, "I don't know what I'm going to do with this. This is such an awesome thing. Do I really want to cash this ticket?" I'm like, "Dude, come on, just take a picture and frame it, and frame the picture and cash the ticket." So he did.
Copy yours work.
He did ultimately cash the ticket. It was $100. He cashed out for $2,000.
Not bad at all.
No.
Patrick, last thing, and then I'll let you go to wrap up here. I know we're not going to air until Thursday, so very subject to change. But I just wanted to. There's a couple of big games in college this week: Michigan State, sure. Penn State, Washington, Oregon, Georgia, LSU, Wisconsin, Michigan. None of them have seen a ton of line movement yet. I saw Georgia moved up from 7 to 7.5.
Yes, sir.
But anything you're hearing through the grapevine on those early games yet, or anything big in the NFL on Chiefs Pats?
Yeah, I'll run through a couple real quick with you. I talked about some of this college football with Derek Wilkinson. He's a supervisor at the Superbook, home of the Super Contest, which is NFL, but this is on college. Huskies -3 against Oregon. Derek thinks this game could get the upset alert. The line hasn't moved at all yet, but he feels like Oregon might be in a good spot here.
I'm leaning Oregon early. It said it's only Tuesday, but I kind of Oregon has impressed me so far this year. I didn't think they were going to be good, but I like them.
Yeah, a little better than they expected, and they should have beat Stanford. That was just terrible play calling. You can't do that. Georgia-LSU, as you alluded to, Georgia opened 7-point favorite on the road. Bettors have taken a stand at the Superbook. It is at 7.5, as you alluded to. It went to 7.5 earlier this morning in Vegas. So I think that's kind of interesting, LSU getting the hook. LSU coming off that loss, they really can't afford another loss, certainly not at home. So I think that's interesting. This is the one that really stood out most to Derek, was that Wisconsin-Michigan game you mentioned. Wolverines opened 7.5. It hasn't moved, but Derek said they got some action right away on Badgers plus 7.5. And he thinks this is going to get to 7 and maybe even 6.5 in the next couple of days. So it'll be interesting to see if that plays out the way he thinks, as we get toward the end of the week here and closer to Saturday kickoff.
That's actually interesting to me. I leaned Wisconsin a little bit, but I thought if anything it would kind of stay there, not move across that big number seven, just because how often public a team like Michigan can be.
Right, exactly, and it may get to, if it goes to seven, it may just stay at seven and stay alone. But he thinks there will be some Badgers money, some more interest at plus 7.5 to at least bring that down to seven. And he speculates maybe it gets to 6.5. I'm not so sure about that, but we'll see. And he certainly knows the business. And then I'll throw you a little NFL real quick. Chiefs Patriots obviously -3.5 on the Patriots. And this was in discussions with Jeff Stoneback, who's director of trading for MGM Sportsbooks. And he's just not sure what the public is going to do with this game, because you've got Kansas City, which is 5-0 straight up and against the spread. And he said the public has been betting KC every week and all in love with Patrick Mahomes, and rightly so. But the public always likes New England as well, which is at home in this game and playing much better of late. So that's going to be really interesting. Plus, that's the Sunday night game. Books are going to have – there's going to be a ton of money on that game. And there's going to be a lot of parlay and teaser liability into that game as well, that's going to roll out of the Sunday afternoon. So there's certainly going to be some of that alive. And so it's going to be interesting. Jeff's just not sure which way anybody's going to go in that game. And then Eagles-Giants Thursday night game, both teams need a win. Philly opens -3. MGM books in an interesting position here because they've got the sports book at the Borgata in New Jersey, and, of course, they've got the books here in Vegas. And Jeff's just curious how this will work at the Borgata, whether they're going to get an Eagles influx because it's fairly close to Philly, or because it is New Jersey, maybe they'll see a regional bias on both teams here and get a mix of Giants and Eagles money. But he expects that the book is going to need the Giants here in the end. He thinks more of the public is going to weigh in on the Eagles, and that the book is going to need the Giants for this game.
Yeah, I thought that was going to be interesting, their first meeting since it got legalized here in New Jersey. Well, actually, we're recording out of New York, but a New Jersey native. So right. I thought that's going to be interesting to see where some of that public money will be going. But hey, Patrick, this has been a lot of fun. Really, really appreciate you coming on to the show this week, and we're definitely going to have you back. It was awesome to talk some lines and then get a little more inside baseball on the whole gambling industry.
Sure, anytime. Just dial me up.
Sounds good. You have a good one out there in Vegas, and we'll talk soon.
Absolutely.
And that is it for our show. We are now off to Yankee Stadium. And join us next week. Subscribe to the podcast. Download. Tell your friends about it. You can email us at moralpodcast@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, Jared_Shanker. Follow the podcast at Victories Moral on Twitter. And on Instagram, it's Moral Victories. See y'all next week.